it's either bichelet or an onion ring.
I get that.
Yeah.
There's like plenty of vegetables I like fried. Yeah.
But I'll go to Whataburger and be like, I want a burger, no onions.
With onion rings.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Whataburger has a good onion ring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Raw onion, she'll pick off a salad, you know, but she'll definitely do the other. Yeah. So
too true. Bloomin' onion. I'm a big fan of the bloomin' onion.
Sure. She'll eat the bloomin' onion as well. I think. Yeah.
So it's the fried onion, you're good. It's the
texture thing.
Really slimy or the bitter cold.
Yeah, and I think some of the, the bites taken out of them in the cooking process.
Well, this is what I like about a good onion burger. It's like a real char on the onion because like crunchy.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
Like almost like caramelized the onion.
Yeah, Ugh. And I love an onion in all its states. So,
and most people don't know that the onion actually imported from Japan.
Okay, we are rolling.
Yeah.
Well, just a little bit of Oklahoma food talk. Yeah.
Is the onion really a Japanese?
I don't know.
Okay, I don't think so.
That would be a very fun fact if it were true, but
it's
fun for it to be a lie as well. Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast. We gather around a table, we discuss the films you'll never discuss, and the film stays course. We have a potpourri month going on here, and
maybe it was.
It is. Well, Central Asia, so it's
China,
a little further away. Because that's on the east east extreme there.
But close.
Fun. Well, wow. Your intuition was almost correct. That's very fun. I'm still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I'm still Dalton. Wow, we got that out of the way quick. We haven't talked about the movie yet.
Well, we're going to be watching The Last Samurai this week, which is a host pick from Dalton in our potpourri month.
Next week, we're going to be watching The First Samurai.
It's out of order. Much, much earlier.
In the Samurai Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
Man,
I'm thousand years earlier prequel.
I'm there for this. Yeah. I am so there for
Ken
this.
Ken Watanabe's ancestor.
I mean, we maybe get that Predator one in there some point.
I want it. I got a host pick this month, and I picked The Last Samurai because I persuaded Keithan to tell me that his Patreon pick was Silence, and in exchange I had to pick a related film for that early intelligence, and I was like, well, let's make a Japan sandwich out of the bad Roadhouse movie.
Well, it's more like a samurai sushi roll, right, with Josie and the Pussycats in the middle.
Well, no, we did Roadhouse in between.
Roadhouse in the middle. That's right. That was in the middle. Sorry.
Yeah. But you're right. It is sort of more of a sushi roll in some ways.
Yeah.
Which is not, that's an American thing. Roll, of course.
Sure.
That's one of our little oddities. We just love taking your food and fucking it up a little bit. Well, that's kind of our whole American deal.
That's the American way, baby.
In case you're tuning in for the very first time, we also like to mess up your film watching experience by spoiling the film. If you have not seen 1997's The Last Samurai, is 97?
2003.
Really? Is it? Really?
I know. It feels like it's a 90s
movie.
It's so
90s.
I know, dog. We'll talk about it.
Okay. Well, anyway, 2003 is The Last Samurai. If you have not seen that film, we will be spoiling it in the last two-thirds of the show. But in the first third, we'll avoid this, and these are the markers you want to watch out for in case you want to catch the movie before you hear the rest. We'll have a synopsis, which will be, of course, spoiler-free. We'll have quick thumbs-up, thumbs-down reviews, which will talk about what happens, but not like the details that make the film-watching experience enjoyable. Then we move on to a little game called Expanding the Syllabus, wherein which we might have thematic spoilers, but we tend to avoid plot spoilers, and if there are any plot spoilers, they're pretty light. Then we play music to let you know we've gotten down to business. That's when we've all spoiled bets. You guys are the worst.
Yeah, we're trying to distract them a little bit.
It's been a good time. So with all that, Arthur, would you like to, come to work?
No, I don't.
And give us a synopsis, please.
Nathan Algren, an alcoholic ex-army captain marketed as an American hero, is hired by Omura to come train the recently formed Japanese imperialist army. Yet, after suffering a defeat at the hands of the samurai, Algren is taken captive, and he begins to realize who the true enemy is.
Yes, that is the movie. So, thank you very, very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. We've all seen this movie before. Arthur has not. You are the virgin watcher. Therefore, you are the first reviewer. I would love to hear your thoughts on it.
I've been watching this movie since I was 13 years old.
That's wild.
Yeah.
I just never got around to this. Came out of the period where I was like not a Tom Cruise guy.
Sure.
And then I just never got to it now that I am a Tom Cruise guy. And so, and then in my post-Tom Cruise Messiah, I'm glad to finally get to this one because this is kind of one of the big, in that kind of period of his career. There are a few of those, Magnolia and... Mm-hmm. A couple of others in there that I haven't seen. And so, yeah, man, I like this movie. It, first encounter with it, I think it whips pretty good. I could see going up or down. I think on a rewatch, there are some moments where it feels like it just sort of loses some momentum. There's some very quiet moments that feel, unnecessary for what the rest of the movie, I think, is.
It's a little too conventional at times, too.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah. And that maybe, and Zwick isn't somebody I'm very familiar with. I've seen a couple of his movies, but I mean, he's done a lot of these sort of historical narratives and epics and things like that. And that sort of seems to be his primary bread and butter and interest is in these sort of more historical stories. He's done some more modern, you know, Love and Other Drugs and things like that.
Siege.
But, yeah.
He's got a handful.
So he kind of works, but yeah, he's very, you know, nothing super, I don't think, flashy or stylistic about his approach. He's just a competent storyteller, I think. He's made a career of it. Obviously, Tom Cruise is someone who now I really enjoy. I think he's highly entertaining. Was able to make this movie into a massive success, you know, which I think is impressive. Ken Watanabe, I really enjoy here. I think they've got a fun dynamic back and forth and are a pretty good time together. It just, there's all of the kind of action stuff, the sort of characters in a room talking with one another is all so engaging and dynamic that I get really just pulled into it. And so I have a lot of fun with it. Cruise's, you know, Algren's journey of trying to be accepted by the lieutenant in the camp who's like just keeps sparring him and embarrassing him, and they finally get to have their little moment is fun. There's a fun payoff there.
Hiroyuki Sanada beating him down is just like a classic, like, here's our American protagonist who doesn't know how to get his ass kicked. Simply will stand back up every time.
Yeah. And then samurai armor's cool. Like, yeah. Visually, I mean, it's great on the screen. It's just so impressive. And I think that's a lot of fun as well. So I had a good time with it, you know. The first act I think I was really into, and then again it felt like it lost momentum a couple of times, but I still had a really good time by the end. I wish the ending would have fully committed in another direction, but obviously Tom Cruise is a movie star and there are certain things that probably get put into that contract, and so because of that we get an ending that I think is a little cheap. But other than that, I had a real good time with it. I really enjoyed it, really liked it. We'll revisit.
Very good, very good. What do you think, Dalton? Do you like this movie? I mean, you picked it, so you must like it some, or were you trying to afflict us with it?
I had not seen it in quite some time, so I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it. I used to own it. You know, parsed down my DVD collection to make room for more Blu-rays, so I don't own it anymore. Yeah, I was excited to revisit, and pretty much it held up to my memory of what it was, which is a movie we don't make a ton anymore. The last one of these to get made was The Woman King, and by one of these, I mean like a Hollywood historical blockbuster, which says, let's take a cool time and place in world history and Hollywoodify it. Let's make the morals clear. Let's set up good guys and bad guys and dramatic character arcs, and let's, you know, make sure that we can...
Your brave hearts here,
Make sure we can put some American actors in here, we'll have a good time.
Do get it. It has to be fitted with, like, a fantasy or a sci-fi. Like, there has to be, like, that one other thing. Vampires or zombies.
Now,
or,
yeah.
You know, there's got to be some other little hook to it.
For sure. And, hopefully The Woman King did okay business, so maybe we get some more of these in the coming years. This is a genre that I have a lot of affection for. Obviously, these kinds of movies are not historically accurate. We're not going to spend a ton of time talking about the historicity of this. If you want to, longtime listeners will remember our friend Dan Lefebvre, who I interviewed on People's History of Film. He's got that podcast based on a true story. He does have an episode on The Last Samurai with Dr. Brian Dirk. It's pretty good. I've listened to most of it, and so if you want to get into, like, learning more about, you know, how the Tokugawa Shogunate, which is going, you know, you learn about that on the show Shogun. Do you want to know how that relates to this? I'll talk about that a little bit. You want to know more about the Meiji Restoration, what that meant for samurai? Great stuff in there. For this movie, we're, you know, going to pretend the samurai weren't kind of evil and corrupt and taking advantage of the Japanese people for 1,000 years.
And an emblem of a caste system.
Yeah.
Right.
We're going to, you know, just think about how noble it is to be a kick-ass warrior who loves to do warfare and hates ideology. Does that make any sense? No, it's kind of fascist. But, you know, Hollywood action movies are that sometimes. And that can be okay. You know, we can have fun and go, damn, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And then kind of pick apart the politics and figure out how we feel about it and what it means. So that is sort of the war you're going to find yourself at the war you're going to find within yourself watching Last Samurai if you're trying to have like serious intellectual thoughts about it. If you just get swept up in a big Hollywood epic, you're going to have a great time. I really think you will. Arthur's right. There's some pretty cheap stuff in the end that is kind of conventional, as I said already. But I think I'm mostly aligned with you, Arthur, that stuff is not really earned, doesn't kind of some, I think I know exactly what you're talking about. Like the ending. Is that kind of one of the things you're hitting on? Or just sort of,
I'm in the battle.
Oh, the battle. I thought you meant like literally the very end. Okay.
I mean, the very end is there because of the battle.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. So but I guess there's a handful. Parcel. Yeah. Kind of that last 20
that
minutes.
Same ending to Man the Iron Mask.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, a handful of things that'll, you know, if you're wanting something unconventional, you're not going to be satisfied. But if you, as Arthur said, you know, Zwick doesn't do anything that reinvents the wheel with his action photography, but it is clean, it is deliberate, it is medium shots, it is not a lot of cuts. It is good action, competent action photography that gives you a sense of geography and a sense of what people are doing. And sorry, this is what we complained about on Roadhouse last week. Like, we want action that, you know, sure, if you can do something visually with your action that excites and elevates and makes what your actors and your stunt team have put together even more exciting, great. If you can't, do it in a medium, dude, and don't cut. And that's what you get here is some really satisfying sword fights, both of intimate small-scale sword fights with a cool ninja attack or training scenes, as Arthur has alluded to. But then you get these grand artillery fights with, you know, cannon rounds going off and horse stunts. We do, it does make us sad when the horsies have to do stunts. It's more dangerous for them than for people. They're still sick though. And that is one of the things that is so interesting about this movie as an early 21st century film is it does feel like an old school Hollywood movie in terms of like tons of human extras, tons of explosions, tons of unsafe stuff. And it's just like, wow, we really stopped making movies like this for a lot of practical reasons. I mean, this movie cost $140 million in 2003 money. That's crazy. That's not, they weren't spending that kind of money on movies yet, especially non-superhero movies. So I tried to find information on if this went over budget and couldn't really find that kind of detail. But Zwick writes about this in his book. He's got a new memoir out, something called like My 40-something Journey, 40-something Year Journey in Hollywood or something like that. There's a chapter on this film that was published on Vulture. Yeah, on Vulture with a foreword by Bilge Ebri. I always forget how to say his name, but Bilge. It's pretty good stuff in there if you want to just like learn about how easy having Tom Cruise makes it to make your movie. So Zwick kind of talks about how easy this film went compared to basically every other film he ever made, which is interesting. So that's why it costs $140 million, because they'll just throw money at your movie if you got Tom Cruise. And it shows, you know, he spent a year like doing kendo and kenjutsu and learning how to swing a sword, and it paid off. You know, he looks competent next to guys like Hiroyuki Sanada, who's been, you know, practicing sword stuff his whole life. It looks good. It's very exciting. It's, you know, it's fun in that way of war is bad, but isn't it cool? The camaraderie that develops between warriors. It's kind of that classic bullshit, but I find that stuff fun. I like that kind of pathos of like characters coming together and, you know, kind of buddy cop stuff, but a little more on the dramatic side, you know, and it's got all that. And those aspects work for me. We'll talk about what doesn't work here in a little bit, but I do think it's an exciting adventure film for the most part. And, you know, a complicated protagonist, right? A guy who is like fully evil at the start of the film, or at the very least weighed down haunted by evil deeds, we can say. That's always a good starting point for a character and give us a lot to talk about. So I'm thankful for that. Dustin, you've seen this a couple times, right?
I have. I don't have a count, but I've seen it quite a few times.
Yeah.
Less than 10, more than 4.
Okay.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe 5 times, but I'm really not sure. And it is, I mean, it absolutely, if you can get swept up in the ride, it is a great ride. Performances are really good. Our Japanese cast is excellent throughout the film. I love the costumes, just costumes in general. You talk about how samurai armor is cool, but the costumes all the way through, the American kimonos. Scenes, the kimonos, and also just you know, more casual wear, the royal wear, all of that is great. The way in which the outfit, even the more westernized Japanese characters,
the Meiji, the military police, too. They're kind of fits.
Yeah. Really, really great there. Also, just whoever the armor master was working on the period pistols and cannons, the howitzers, all of that stuff looks really, really, really solid. I think the score is pretty good, too. It's never distracting, but it is appropriately maudlin to make you feel what you're supposed to be feeling in a given moment, which is, again, what this kind of, I mean, you look at Braveheart or other these sort of big sword epics. It's definitely in the same vein as that kind of filmmaking. So that all works. Story-wise, it fish out of water, learning away, sort of going native is that kind of narrative, which has a varying kind of mileage based on what kind of viewer you are. I'm the one who didn't care for Avatar because it was Dances with Blue Pocahontas, and I kind of have the same kind of feelings about this as well.
Yeah.
And so it loses a whole star for me for ideology purposes. Same. And that, and again, that sort of miffed ending, I think, it really should have... It shouldn't have gone the way it went. And that's okay, though, because if you're signed up for what it's doing, it is very, very fun. And so I found myself caught up in the sweep of it. I love this kind of world. I like exploring this kind of world. And so my little Asiatic mind sort of begins to fire in various places. And I dig all of that about it. But the edges are all kind of sanded off and smooth and glotzy and glitzy. And that's okay.
In that Hollywood way.
In that Hollywood way.
Sounds like you're on board with my Letterboxd review, which I think is something like full of the dopest stuff you've ever seen, but held by, back by its own inherent story problems or something like that.
Yeah, ideological. Again, a number of sort of American problems sort of plague this particular movie. I think Cruz is actually quite good, though. I think Cruz plays his pathos really, really well. I think he's outshone by pretty much everybody else on screen. I mean, even Peter Pettigrew is doing a better work, I think, at
playing Timothy Small. Yeah.
He's only going to be Peter Pettigrew.
That's that man do look like a rat.
He does. Good casting on the Harry Potter.
I don't have to tell you,
But yeah, I think it all works for the most part. I think, and I, you know, you say we talked about the sort of cinematography loving the landscape in Silence, and it does the same thing here
for sure.
But really, go to Japan and your movie's better.
Well, they didn't. They went to New Zealand.
Okay, well,
but they scouted in Japan.
And I mean, we're still in the the Pacific out there.
Exactly, the Pacific Rim, as it were.
So, I mean, that all catches that same kind of flavor, you know. And so, if you love those landscapes, you're gonna love this movie. And lovingly looking at the going to those kinds of locations is gonna automatically make your movie better.
Totally.
Just period.
Yep.
So it works. It works. It works. Except for when you think about it.
Working on my new screenplay for The Last Kaiju.
Let's go. You want to know who did that perfectly serviceable score?
Hans Zimmer.
That's right.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Perfectly serviceable.
He, look, you know what? He's no John Williams, but he's no slouch either.
No.
You know what I mean? Absolutely.
So there you go, dear listener. Our thoughts are generally pro regarding The Last Samurai, and we're going to move on to the next part of our show, which is called Expanding the Syllabus. And Dalton is going to tell us what that's all about.
Yes, I will, Dustin. This is the part of the show where we deliver on the promise of our premise. We talk about the films you wouldn't discuss in a film studies course, but we do it in a film studies type way. What's that mean? Well, we're going to take The Last Samurai and pair it with other films, other stories, other media, other books about film, other texts, let's say, and we're going to compare them, contrast them, find common themes, pull out sort of the things that we're most interested in with The Last Samurai, and build a class around it. Now, it's been brought to my attention that I'm a very good boy, and I let Arthur do his thing, but I have to give color commentary during Dustin's syllabuses all the time. So I'm going to be a nice, sweet little gentleman. Let everyone do their talking. Am I going to have to go first, or can Arthur go first?
I was going to ask you to go first, if you don't want to. You can pass...
No, let Arthur go first, and then I can get it all out of my system before you talk.
Okay.
Yeah.
Art, let's hear your syllabus.
So I'm doing the Tom Cruise class. I want to do the artist study of Tom Cruise's prolific and historic career. And so that's what we're going to be doing. Tom Cruise, movie star. The last movie star, maybe. And so we would start maybe by taking a look at De Cordova's picture personalities to talk about the star system and establishing what a movie star is, isn't. Looking at some of those fun terms as well. Maybe talking about cell phone face. which I had no issue with here. No issues at all with Tom Cruise as this lieutenant in the Army who goes to Japan. No qualms with him whatsoever.
It's a middle rank. It's very important. It's middle rank.
Okay.
Yeah.
The doctor on Dan Lefebvre's podcast was like, there's no way he would like speak English and also not know what a captain was. That's just simply straight incorrect. That was one of the things that really bothered him.
That's funny. The other textbook we'd be using is Amy Nicholson's Anatomy of an Actor, Tom Cruise, published from Kaidu Cinema and Phaedon, which just outlines, she goes through to outline 10 sort of prolific roles of his through his career, kind of tracking his rise and current trajectory. She ends this here with Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol in 2011, which is kind of where he really makes his full sort of triumphant return to film. So to work through this, we're just going to kind of go through the book. We may do some other stuff. We may start actually with The Outsiders, which is Cruise does a couple of early movies kind of playing psycho type characters, which almost gets him typecast, but he pushes back against that. And so he actually seeks out a movie to lead that flops, is poorly reviewed, poorly attended. And then he seeks out Coppola to be in The Outsider. So he gets a bit part there. And then he does Risky Business. And that's kind of where the book starts proper, is with his role there as Joel Goodson in that film of this young adult or this young kid who uses his house as a brothel. And then things ensue. That's really where he sort of has his first successful leading role is with Risky Business. So that's kind of where we would start proper. And then Top Gun is going to put him over the edge. So we'd go there next where he plays Pete Maverick Mitchell. From there, we would go into Born on the 4th of July, kind of probably the first instance of him attempting to do this sort of I'm an actor, please believe me, I can act sort of thing that he does with Oliver Stone.
Yeah, I don't just do commercials for the military. I also challenge the military.
Yeah. So we would go there and kind of start talking and thinking about him trying to shake off this, maybe not movie star persona, but that he does have depth to him. And this is something he sort of pursues through this period of time. We'd take a look at his role as Lestat in Interview with a Vampire.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go into Jerry Maguire. And then into Eyes Wide Shut, another instance of him. The man has just worked with, we always lighten him with, you know, as the movie star, but he's also worked with like the best of the best directors as well, which is also very impressive. So we talk about that, the way he actively will seek out or would seek out directors to work with, because I think he understood the kind of shine and someone who deeply does seem to have a love of movies. I think historically
watches a movie a day.
That's what he says. And maybe he does. Who's to say?
We should all be so lucky.
If only. We try to get close, though. We take a look at Magnolia, where he works with Paul Thomas Anderson. And then we'd go into War of the Worlds, working with Spielberg here in post 9/11 work. Pretty effective movie, I think. A very effective performance from him. And then after watching that, we're going to watch The Interview to talk about his reputation in the 2005 interview with Oprah, where he jumps on the couch while promoting War of the Worlds and talk about how it turned him into a joke.
It spun him out for a while. Yeah,
it hurt his career. And then the whole Scientology thing didn't help.
David Miscavige lurking in the background.
And so it takes him a few years to recover. And so we'd go to 2008's Tropic Thunder, where he really gets a good chance because he gets to kind of make fun of himself in Les Grossman's character. And then finally back to Mission Impossible, the sort of that franchise, which he used to revitalize his career and action filmmaking in some blockbuster filmmaking. I should say not action, but both, I guess. Not fight choreography, you know, not John Wick stuff, but just big spectacle filmmaking.
But also, I mean, good fight choreography in those movies, too.
Him and Henry Cavill in that bathroom, huh?
Yeah. That stuntman, that three-way fight in, is that Rogue Nation or is that The Fallout? Yeah, it's Fallout.
Yeah.
That's so sick. Yeah.
Yeah. Oof. It was Henry Cavill pumping those fists.
Well, gotta reload them hands, baby.
I mean, that's what we do. We take a look at Tom Cruise's sort of rise and somewhat fall and now his preoccupation with trying to kill himself to make movies.
Yep.
And so that's where we would go.
Very good. I like that a lot. What does your syllabus look like, Dalton?
Just thinking about Tom Cruise's Les Grossman telling the key grip to punch Steve Coogan in the face really hard. It's a bit that came up last night at Down in Front. I think about all the time. We are going to be talking, of course, about white saviors and Orientalism. You thought we would get away with it? No, certainly not.
Edvar Said.
No, we have to talk about it this week. Mm-hmm. We simply have no other choice. So I thought, like, how do we define this? And I found it really well done by Matthew Huey from an article, The Whiteness of Oscar Night, from 2015. So I'm just going to read from that article real quick. It kind of describes the narrative structure of this subgenre. So here again, from Matthew Huey, a white savior film is often based on some supposedly true story. Second, it features a non-white group or person who experiences conflict and struggle with others that is particularly dangerous or threatening to their life and livelihood. Third, a white person, the savior, enters the milieu and through their sacrifice as a teacher, mentor, lawyer, military hero, aspiring writer, or wannabe Native American warrior is able to physically save, or at least morally redeem, the person or community of folks of color by the film's end. Examples of this genre include films like Glory, Dangerous Minds, Amistad, Finding Forrester, this week's film The Last Samurai, Half Nelson, Freedom Riders, Gran Torino, Avatar, The Blind Side, and The Help. Of course, that barely scratches the surface. There are, of course, Denis Villeneuve and David Lynch's Dunes, which we can talk about how that complicates white savior narratives in this class. Sure. We're talking about how Frank Herbert like wanted to crack that open and blah, 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 blah. It still counts. Mm-hmm. It's still one of them, even though it's doing a deconstruction, we still have to talk about it. Obviously I have to talk about T.E. Lawrence and Lawrence of Arabia, both the real life person and the myth making behind that person and sort of the real world historical events that lead to these stories being so prevalent, right? The sort of Western colonial project that exists throughout, you know, the second half of the second millennium, that sort of makes these stories so baked into Western culture, because so much of Western culture becomes about interfacing with communities of color and other cultures and exploiting them.
Sure.
And then we want to go backwards and rewrite a narrative where we can say, no, what about the good whites that were out there trying to learn and grow and change? And so these are Hollywood narratives that sort of let especially mainstream audiences, but especially white mainstream audiences, feel a little bit better about the historical projects that have taken place. And again, we've barely scratched the surface on the movies that could fall under this category. I'm sure when we get into business time, we'll start throwing a few more out. But I thought Matthew Huey did a really good job of kind of laying out some like very key prominent examples from the last 30 years or so. So I didn't feel really too compelled to put together my own list, just because I mean you can find it everywhere. It's not mm-hmm. all, you know, Avatar and Dances with Wolves. It's the Great Debaters. Oh my god,
Dangerous Minds.
Well, Dangerous Minds, Hidden Figures. There we go.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Which is a little bit better about this than some movies, but Kevin Costner's still there. Yeah. And gets to knock down a bathroom sign in that movie. Right.
Right.
So it's all over both like civil rights movies. It's all over historical action movies. It is a trope and a narrative, that finds its way in. Now, where does Orientalism fit into this? You know, we might bring in some science fiction stories that kind of play with white savior narratives, like Dune, but maybe even Blade Runner 2049, which is a little bit better about this because it's also complicating, but it's still got its own bugaboos we got to deal with, especially the Orientalism that is kind of in both Blade Runner movies and a lot of cyberpunk fiction and a lot of mm-hmm. Western science fiction. And we can kind of talk about sort of that adventurist project of the West that kind of creates this air of mystery and intrigue around, you know, the Eastern Hemisphere of the world and both, you know, North African and Middle Eastern milieus, you know, Far Eastern milieus, how these different communities and cultures throughout that hemisphere kind of been glamorized, exploited, etc., by, you know, American and Western storytelling. That's the class.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's going to make everybody feel like shit, but, you know, we'll also get to watch some cool action scenes.
Sometimes that's valuable, though.
Both things can be true, you know?
Yeah.
Truly breathtaking action can be right next to some of the most dumb, boneheaded ideas you've ever seen.
Certainly.
Yeah. Well, Dustin, how would you teach Last Samurai?
So I think what I would teach Last Samurai, as a module within a class on the Japanese Chanbara film is what I would do. And I'm saying Chanbara instead of samurai because I want to do ninjas too. Mm. This is my desire.
As one does.
It's my class. That's what I want to do. So there'd be like an original module where you would look at just sort of the classical origins of the samurai film. 47 Ronin would come up in that kind of section there. Maybe some of the early silent features that do this kind of work as well. Maybe we'd go ahead and watch Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon at this point. I do want to have an individual module for just Kurosawa and his stuff, but obviously, we'd move from that into like the Samurai Trilogy and some of these other filmmakers that have done some good work in the 40s and 50s in the samurai genre. And then, obviously, then we look at some of those Shinobi and Nomono and some of those original ninja films as well. Again, sort of staying in that Japanese production milieu to begin with. Then I would move into some of those Western adaptations and transformations of those films. And I think with the samurai film in the West, Last Samurai is a good example of this. I think Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai from Jim Jarmusch is a good example there. Also looking at Les Samurai, the 70s film noir-esque, but also samurai-esque kind of film, and thinking about the Western imagination regarding the world of the samurai at that point. It would be really, really kind of fascinating there. Then, of course, we would move, obviously, to some of the Western ninja movies. There's a ton of those that we could use for that. I think those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles themselves would have to make an appearance in that section as well. And then I would talk about the genre mashups, the ways in which these movies become other kinds of movies. And you see some of that already with Les Samurai and a little bit of that with Ghost Dog, but then really get into some of the spaghetti westerns and their connection to the works of Akira Kurosawa and the way in which the western becomes kind of a samurai film. And so there'd be a number of movies that we would look at there, but I would use this film in that sort of western appropriation of the genre. And this is probably the cleanest of those appropriations insofar as it is starring quite a few Japanese actors playing samurai in that moment. And so thinking about what that looks like and how those East meets West transferences take place.
I know I promised not to interject too much, but I do want to remind everyone about a film we learned about when we did our Coen-esque marathon. Mm-hmm. We were talking about international remakes. This all gets looped back around on itself where the samurai movie becomes a Western with Ken Watanabe and the 2013 Unforgiven remake.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which I really think we got to cover on this show at some point.
Well, we'd already begin that. I mean, when Kira Kurosawa does Seven Samurai, you know, he very much is making an American Western with samurai. Which is fascinating because then the American Western remake of it, The Magnificent Seven, is the same thing, but different. And so the ways in which East meets West, that flow, the particle flow goes both ways. And so we've got to be sure we're seeing the various ways in which those streams are crossing.
Yeah. I mean, and again, like you get Le Samurai in there, which could kind of give you the opportunity to just shout out like Breathless and how like it goes across both oceans, right? Mm-hmm. Like this sort of cultural transformation or transmogrification that happens through film is so sick. And I mean, I'm always glad when you bring one of these classes to the table because you've got a good, you know, depth of knowledge to kind of show how these things interconnect.
And I think it'd be fun. And again, doing it in Chanbara, then spending that time with ninjas, because ninjas become the sort of standard villains, you know, in 80s action movies and the ways in which, you know, the heroic ninja. And then there's this weird moment in the early 2000 teens where there's sort of like ninja samurai kind of angst in fandoms. And so I think also watching strategies, fan groups, and the ways in which those things are created around these various modes of filmmaking, I think would be also kind of an interesting opportunity for maybe like a suggestion for a research paper for students in a class like that. I mean, I think I really am going to write this class. I think this is going to be a thing that's going to happen at some point.
I'm slowly passing a sheet of paper over to you that says hard boiled next to John Wick.
Oh, sure.
Sort of talking about Hong Kong and 8711 Productions and sort of how they are kind of in that Hong Kong lineage of doing it for real.
So I really want to keep it separate. I really want to stay Japanese with this one because the Hong Kong thing, that's a slate of classes.
That's true. It's a whole own class
for me. And so, how Wuxia meets heroic bloodshed is kind of its own beast there.
Yeah,
and the Koreas themselves, you know, I mean, there's real diversity there in East Asia, and we really got to pay maybe closer attention to some of those cultural distinctivenesses, because the role of World War II reparations and Reconstruction also really kind of plays a role in our Japanese consumption of media here in the West as well, just because of the presence of bases after the ending of the war.
I mean, same with Korean cinema, right? Which, you know, I mean, we've talked about a bunch on this show, like the 50s through the 2000s and how that kind of relates to, you know, interplay with American culture and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
And there's another 50s American film that I might even use, Sayonara, which Marlon Brando stars in this. And it's sort of this star-crossed lover kind of story where he and Red Buttons play two guys on a base who are buddies, officers, and they both fall in love with Japanese women. And there's a lot of discussion of seppuku in this particular film. And so I think there could be something going on there as well. And the way in which it becomes this... The meditations on mortality themselves and how they are westernized, I think, are really, really kind of interesting as well. So James Clavell's Shogun would probably be something that would come up at some point in the recent FX series, which I've seen a couple episodes of now so far, which is very solid. I really, really like
it. I'm glad you got it started finally.
And I really do enjoy it. And the way in which some of the representation issues are some of the wrongs are righted. And different.
Because you've read the novel, right?
I have read the novel, yeah. So, and I really I love the book. I think the book's great.
They kind of fix some stuff in the show?
At this point, I can't tell much difference.
Oh, okay.
Or any difference is significant, at least from the novel.
Okay, cool.
So,
well, it's interesting that they didn't have to tweak too much to like keep it doing service to all of its characters.
Now, in fairness, I only read the book once, and it is a doorstop, and I read it 10 years ago.
Okay.
So we'll be totally fair there.
Well, now we got to move on. Otherwise, we're just going to talk about Shogun.
Yeah, your syllabus just got longer, keeps getting longer, and I believe now it's time we get down to business. That's right, dear listener, and that business is, as always, analysis.
I do want to talk about Shogun really briefly, just because I feel like it's interesting to bring into the conversation here, right?
Yeah, because, I mean...
Because of the way it portrays samurai versus the way this portrays samurai.
Well, and the shared actor as well, you know.
Of course.
You know, which is...
Hiroyuki, yeah.
Which is really his performance. I mean, he's a really, really, really solid actor, and he's in a lot of these ninja samurai movies from the 2000s through the teens. I mean, he's an overwhelming presence in Japan.
Well, the Japanese executives from Warner Brothers wanted him for the Watanabe role. I forget the general's name. Katsumoto. They wanted Hiroyuki Sanada for Katsumoto
instead of Watanabe.
Yeah, and Zwick and his casting director, I guess, just like really popped, and he really popped, and they really connected with what he was doing. And I guess he was kind of at a much worse point in his career. He had just gotten through a battle with leukemia, which I had never heard about.
Me either.
I guess he was in bad with some kind of shady money wise, some shady managers, and maybe there's some Yakuza money. So he was doing like just any TV job he could get, and it was really kind of hurting his career. So this is kind of an, you know, obviously Arthur already talked about like where this fits into Tom Cruise's career, but this is kind of a big moment for turning Ken Watanabe into an international star.
Yeah, it is.
And then again, Hiroyuki Sanada kind of signing on to be Yujiro and be the sort of the number two, you know, the right hand character, kind of legitimizes everything as well.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, we've already talked about the White Savior stuff, but lots of people have written about this film being in that context, but Watanabe was asked about that in like a Guardian interview.
This is the thing where we have to have a little bit more nuance where we go, oh yeah, White Savior, gross, right? But,
and also Watanabe goes, well, think about like how Japanese people were portrayed in American film, like throughout the late 20th century and like up to this film.
Buck teeth, glasses.
Yeah, exactly.
Misko Rightley is played by Mickey Rooney.
Yeah. So he's a big fan of this movie, and obviously he's probably going to more likely to defend a film that he was involved in.
Sure.
But Watanabe like has a lot of appreciation for this movie and kind of speaks about it as, you know, legitimizing Japanese culture in American film.
It's not a first effort, you know, to be clear, but it is a big effort.
Yeah,
it's a big swing with real Japanese actors And pop stars, yeah. You know, I mean, there are pop stars as well that are being cast here. But again, their performances are all very, very solid.
Zwick got the studio to give him a ton of money for research, talk to historians, talk to language experts to kind of make sure the differences between casual and formal speech in the Japanese were correct.
Like, that's all a that frequent stuff. Mistake that's made. Yeah. And so, but the representation here by having these actors on screen being represented in a way that is a bit more historically authentic, you know, again, with.
Yeah, we'll circle back to it. Yeah.
With romantic, sentimentalizing, you know, sort of caveats, but we'll give that. But putting all that together in a way that, again, puts these guys and gals on screen in a way that is noble, that is, again, sort of winsome. And just, again, the representation itself matters. You know, we talk about this a lot when we talk about some of the efforts of other movies where we have, you know, problematic race relationships or problematic. The Will and Grace problem, you know.
Performative representation, sure. Or sketchy representation. Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is seeing a person like that on screen is a fundamentally humanizing act. And by doing it in that way, it really does kind of increase the spotlight for those and provide more opportunities and does garner more attention towards diversity in casting offices. And so despite, you know, the problems that we talk about with white savior stuff, having these actors in a major Hollywood film doing stuff that is not just the plucky sidekick, not just the maid, not just the, you know, those sort of standard kind of roles, even, you know, but by having that representation there, it's a move forward. But also the role that those maids played and those bucktooth, you know, tourists with cameras played, by having them there, that also is a move forward, because at one point, not very long in the past, it was Mickey Rooney playing our Japanese neighbor rather than an actual Japanese actor or actress. And so there's a way in which even these problematic moments are also moving the needle forward.
Yeah, this is making me think about, sorry to bring up my other show, but this is making me think about a Down in Front we did a while back. We showed the James Whale film, Wives Under Suspicion.
Okay.
And it's got this actor, Lillian Yarbo, who was like kind of a big name and for like black actresses in the 30s, but it's just a bad role for
sure.
Her. It's no good. But like, she was one of the few things that popped in reviews of the time. So it's a double-edged sword. You can have these kind of terrible, gross, degrading mammy roles that also elevate an actor, get people talking about, get white film critics talking about a performer of color and like giving them flowers and trying to elevate their role.
Anna May Wong, the same era, yeah.
It's crazy. You know, it's a bad business, but like sometimes good things can come out of these sort of, at best, problematic depictions.
Mm-hmm. And so we have to, again, I think we have to acknowledge that. And Watanabe, I mean, obviously he is one of the beneficiaries of this particular choice here in representation. And so, you know, you have to, again, put historical eyes on it, because I think one of the mistakes you might make and one of those sort of tendencies towards canceling, for lack of a better word, given films from a canon, is to say, well, you know, there's a real problem with this movie, but you know, you want to watch Dances with Wolves and go, man, but I'll tell you what, we saw a number of great Native American actors on major screens in an Oscar, you know, winning major Oscar, like, what is the sweep, 12 Oscars or something like that for Dances with Wolves?
A ton.
Scads of Oscars when it came out. And yes, it's got all the Kevin Costner white savior problems, but those actors continued to work and continued to provide opportunities for other actors to work because of their presence in the movie, rather than, you know, again, scheduling or rather casting you know, spray on tanned Italians to play your Native Americans, which was historically the process before then, right? So useful, good, helpful for that to take place. And so I'm grateful for a movie like Dances with Wolves or The Last Samurai, despite its other problems in racial politics.
You know, you always want to be, you look, it's always good to see a Graham Greene or Tantu Cardinal performance.
Yeah,
you know?
Graham Greene. I mean, man, what a great performer, you know.
Oh, for sure.
I just love him.
Hollywood's a tricky beast this way, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it is always one step forward, two steps back. There is no clean progress. It is always messy, which I guess is why I want to maybe we'll take a step backwards in the conversation real quick, circle back to Shogun v. Last Samurai and the depiction of samurai, speaking of like not necessarily historical accuracy, but just at the very least, I don't know how we deal with warrior culture, right? In terms of our storytelling and how we think about these things.
Well, you know what the rule is, right?
What's that?
The rule is that the guy who's good at doing violence has to not love it.
Yeah.
That's the rule. You have to hate it.
You have to abhor violence.
Come to a point where you have hung up your guns.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you find the just cause.
Yes, of course.
And that way, no matter what cause the society might present before young men and women who want to go put on a uniform and play at a soldier, then therefore they are now fighting in the just war like the good samurai or, you know, Western cowboy or whatever it is we're looking at for this. That's the rule. That's the rule of romantic Western warfare storytelling, right?
Well, and then, of course, like it's always joining the underdog cause, right?
Yes.
It's always the tale of like the mercenary or the, the boot of colonialism, like finding its way into the indigenous culture or finding its way into the, you know, the more primitive warfare doing group and realizing that, oh, of course, these were the good guys all along. How could I have been so blind? I mean, we see it all the time, and it's pairs with the white savior thing very often, but it can be a separate thing, right? Well, are they kind of part and parcel with each other, I guess?
It's a bourgeoisie vampirism that some theorists talk about, and you see it in a movie like Titanic, where the upper crust person hangs out with the sort of more ethnically, you know, specific, you know, cultural patterns of another culture, which are also economically depressed. And so by hanging out with those cats, you sort of are able to vampiristically drain life from that and then go on continuing to be a bourgeoisie exploiter, robber baron. But yet now you have a little bit more heart and a little bit more flavor to your life.
Well,
right?
And that, of course, brings us back to an interesting point about the samurai, right? Like part of why they're mad during the Meiji Restoration is they're like, they're getting their pensions taken away.
They're the bad guys.
They couldn't be farmers. They couldn't be merchants. Their job was guy with sword for 1,000 years. And now the government says, sorry, you can't be guy with sword anymore, actually, because you were assholes about it for 1,000 years.
Well, and it's a caste system. It's a nobility.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
it's
feudal lords.
It's putting an end to an aristocracy. Yeah. And so they are fighting it. They're like, wait, this means that the peasants can rise up. Mm-hmm. And this means that we might have to come down, that we might have to, you know, I don't know, share the redistributed wealth. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that cannot be. And so they are just like in India, you know, a movie about, you know, about caste systems and the untouchables there. This movie is about basically those middle class, middle management type saying, no, we can't be having this because then that means I might not have a pool in my backyard.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. I mean, in Shogun early on, right? Is Blackthorne? Is that the...
Yes, John Blackthorne.
Yeah. I just keep thinking about the actor's name because Cosmo Jarvis is such a fun name. But he, there's like the gardener caretaker of his estate that he gets given. And he calls him such and such Sama. And he gets told, no, you can't call him. That's actually
too high.
Don't do that. And that's just
because he knows he's got to call Maroki Sama, the girl, Maria,
Maria
/ Marikai or whatever her name is.
Mariko.
There you go.
So it just being told like, no, certain people don't get certain titles. Like it's a caste system. Mm-hmm. Like this is weak, rigidly defined roles. Certain people. And again, it's an aristocracy thing. It is a genealogy lineage. You're a samurai because your dad was a samurai. And that's happened. It goes on for truly almost 1,000 years,
which is part of what explains the sort of useful or the way in which this becomes a novel way of telling a Western story, because we understand knights and lords and fealty. We understand nobility to a cause. We understand soldiering in these kind of ways. But it's a way in which you can sort of exoticize some of those same kind of stories that would be tired and sort of rote, and then you put on this little additional kind of flavor. So this is one of the problematics of these adaptations there as well.
And I mean, kind of goes to show the ambivalence of a lot of Japanese audiences to this movie, right? Because of the depiction of the samurais being very romantic and, you know, very grand and appreciative, kind of gets a lot of cocked eyebrows, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Samurai Reclamation Project really starts in the early 20th century under like
Imperial Japan and sort of that project of expanding its sphere of influence, you know, throughout the start of world up to the start of World War II,
and living in the shadow of its utter failure at the close of that war,
is
sort of where the cynicism of towards samurai comes, and we don't possess here in the West towards our cowboys or Western expansionists,
that we maybe should have a little bit more suspicion about. Which brings us back to Algren. Brings us back to the Tom Cruise character, right? The great Indian war fighter, and sort of this legend around those guys who are war criminals and genocide doers and not people that we should be valorizing as a culture.
And, you know, I got to say, the movie really does kind of find a way to valorize Custer.
Crazy. Which is weird.
With this strange kind of connection to the Battle of Thermopylae.
Yes, exactly.
And so by making this analogy, and there is an analogy insofar as it is a stand of a lesser number of troops against a greater number of troops, surely, and that eventually the tide turns in the battle despite, you know, the loss at this, you know, the pass at Thermopylae or at Wounded Knee. Little Bighorn.
Yeah.
Little Bighorn is Custer's battle. And so, man, the movie does this wild thing by making this sort of correlation there. And therefore, Katsumoto's stand becomes like Custer's stand. And so the nobility of what Katsumoto is doing in the fiction of the film weirdly sort of transfers to Custer.
Even though, like, Algren Cruz
says
multiple times tries to explain, like, the why that's not a good
he
analogy.
He's a power-mad, egotistical maniac,
which is probably, you know, a self-awareness of the situation that, we, I don't know, is maybe not historically accurate for Algren to have, but I appreciate it. You know, it is very... Sometimes when you make a historical picture, you got to put somebody with a modern perspective in there. And surely throughout our human history, there have been people with modern eyes seeing the world unfolding in whatever backwards age they were in going, my God, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right. You can see it written throughout history of, you know, people being opposed to the Indian Removal Acts, like whatever time or terrible thing you want to look at, there will be dissenters.
There are dissenters, and they're usually silenced. And you know, as bad as ethnocentrism is, that we sort of assume that our culture is best and, you know, knows best and understands, you know, the proper way to behave, walking on the skin of the earth. Chronocentrism is also as evil because ancient peoples were not stupider than us.
Yeah,
and
same brains.
They did understand and they could see the immorality of those things and oftentimes spoke out, but they were frequently silenced, and their views are usually lost to the pages of history because of that sort of censorship.
Well, and of course, I'm finding myself immediately backpedaling, and I want to kind of correct myself because in that, based on a true story episode that I mentioned, Dirk, that Lefebvre talks to, kind of talks about, like, you can find historical accounts of dudes who were in the Indian Wars, like, writing about how horribly traumatized they are by what they saw and what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not, you know, totally, like, a project of everybody thinking they were doing the right thing.
Right.
So it is good. Do we think, you know, they talk a lot about, like, changing your destiny in this film, right? Finding... let me see if I get the right exact line. Yeah, Katsumoto says, do you believe a man can change his destiny? And Algren says, I believe a man does what he can until his destiny is revealed, which again ties back into this sort of valor for warriors, right? Mm-hmm. Like you soldier for the wrong cause until the right hands have need of your rifle or whatever, right? The right cause presents itself to you. Does Algren find redemption through this film if we just accept the fiction of the film and sort of the fiction of its samurais and the fiction of its Meiji restoration? Does Algren change his destiny? Does he find redemption or peace? I mean, obviously he ends up with Taka at the end of the film, sort of the implication, which is the thing that I'm like,
he becomes the trusted counselor, right? He saves Japan.
It's
sort of the assumption the film makes, which is pretty gross.
Well, but also secures an arms deal between Japan and America, which is the most accurate thing.
He blows that up, I mean, at first, right?
Yeah, I guess at first, but it still ends up
happening, we know.
Which is one of the most historically accurate things is, you know, a post-Civil War America had tons of guns that it was perfectly willing to give Japan now that trade was opened. I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the film wants you to have that moment of be like, wow, Algren's really a changed man. I don't buy it. And maybe it's just because I know what a samurai is, and I can't get past, like, as cool as it is to see Ken Watanabe give, I mean, his seppuku performance is...
It's great.
He's so good in this movie. It's, I mean, you, this
it obviously makes sense that he became a superstar internationally off of this film. But yeah, I mean, their friendship is well sketched, and like you believe it, and as far as you believe, like the camaraderie of common duty, right? Or camaraderie of common cause. These, you know, just soldiers.
The camaraderie of proximity. I mean,
sure,
frankly,
I guess, you know, like profession specifically, right? Mm-hmm. Craft bonding people from different walks of life, right? Like, yes, we come from different cultures, but our soldiering bonds us.
Yeah.
And of course, this, again,
and this could be with any kind of crowd, guitar players.
Yeah, exactly. This. It doesn't have to be soldiers.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Again, it's just a trope we use a lot because soldiers mean action.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can kind of get them, you know, using that to bind characters together gives us cool setups for action scenes, mm-hmm. and people learning and growing through dynamic fights and such. I mean, of course, it is the big ninja raid on the compound that like makes them be BFFs,
right?
They become best friends going, you know, back to back in a sword fight. And that is what binds them.
A very good sword fight.
Let's go ahead and action corner real quick. Holy crap. This movie's so cool, guys. I know we've been problematizing it, but this movie's sick as hell. Just like juiciest, bloodiest sword squibs when a dude gets slashed. I mean, huge chunks of earth flying out of the ground from, you know, cannon hits. It's so cool.
Yeah.
It's just, I do, it does make me sad when they make the horsies fall down.
Yes. You
know? I just worry about the horses breaking their legs.
They're really regulated on those stunts as far as I know. And
I know I know that the people riding those horses are really good at putting a horse down and getting it back up. It still scares me.
Yeah. Absolutely. Cause I mean, it's a very, very dangerous maneuver,
yeah.
But from what I understand, and I believe it still had the American Humane Society stamp at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and they really are excellent at using, mannequin doubles for horses as well.
That's true.
I mean, that they've really, I guess, tuned in, you know, the stunt work there to make that work with the way the action cuts and the using the edit to deceive the eye into making it look far more dangerous than it really is.
Well, and I did notice one of those, you know, we were talking about how we don't get to blow stuff up anymore when we covered New Roadhouse. Yes, we blow a ton of real stuff up in this, and there's a lot of real fire. There's some fake fire that is being used to make the real fire look bigger. And honestly,
that works.
It works better than it does in New Roadhouse. Do a little real fire, and your fake fire goes a lot further.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's been Action Corner. This movie does look incredible as far as its set pieces.
I tell you what really took me out of it in terms of action. There's only one misstep, and that is his big sword fight with the four assassins when he's going to Katsumoto.
Before he gets captive.
When Katsumoto's already been taken.
Oh, in the city.
In the city.
Okay.
And he does this sort of entering into the no mind state and sees rewatches the entire fight and knows the guy's coming up. It's too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's weird.
I don't think it quite works the way that they intended it to work. And that's the one misstep I'd want to point out, I suppose.
Because I was just sitting there like, why is he recounting all of this now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just felt,
Yeah, it's like, is he trying to piece together who's still alive of the dudes he cut down?
A full scene-by-scene reenactment.
Yeah.
It's just like with a different filter on it.
It's a cool idea because the no-mind stuff is cool and is like true to martial arts.
Sure.
Right? I mean, I think that's a fun idea. But yeah, maybe a little too far into the Sherlock Holmes Game of Shadows, mind boxing stuff.
There, Guy Ritchie's going to speed it up a lot. It's
sped up, and it's I think it's more legible for the audience what he's looking for because there's a
guidance to it.
There's a long moment where you're just trying to figure out why are we doing this.
Yeah, I was taken out.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
Yeah,
look, all I'm saying is Tom Cruise as a movie star has to die once in a while.
He does.
He should have died in Maverick.
He should die in this,
and he should have died here.
Yeah,
and I think that changes the ending, makes it much more structurally sound and earned.
I mean, him killing Tony Goldwyn works. That, you know, but honestly, that's not a very satisfying kill either. He needed to have a saber on a katana sword fight.
That moment during that final battle when him and Watanabe are like, they're together, they're racing, and then you got the one guy on the hills just like, stop firing. He's like crying. He's seeing like what all this is.
Mm-hmm.
Is so much more effective if we don't get the coda of Tom Cruise showing up.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Because you can still get to the Emperor, like, reassessing what has taken place.
Yeah. You can't have Watanabe walk away from it either. He has to die because the guy he's historically based on dies in that battle, or the battle that is loosely based on.
What you do is you give Bob a line.
Yeah.
Bob the guard, the only samurai to survive. I mean, he dies earlier in this, but you let Bob live. And you have.
It took me a second to remember who Bob was, but yeah, Tom Cruise's body man early.
The elderly one that's like always with him in the city.
He's like, you have tabs Bob on live, him. And you have Bob carry both swords.
And take the swords to the emperor.
Maybe.
Although, you know, I get from a screenplay standpoint, like, Cruise meets the emperor early in the film. Having him meet the emperor is the wraparound.
Yeah, sure.
It's very neat in that Hollywood screenplay way where you're just like, oh my God, not every single thing needs to be tied up in a bow. Like, you're allowed to have loose ends. Come on.
And it feels so much. I mean, it does feel truly motivated, but it's Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Like, if it's anybody else, he dies, I think. I would assume. It's hard to know, but.
I don't know. It does feel very part and parcel with these kinds of stories, though, for that character to live and go on to have a peaceful, like, you know, housewife.
Well, the survivability of bullet wounds in the 19th century does stretch realism a little bit.
He takes like four shots, right?
Yeah. That dude dies of gangrene.
Yeah. I mean, 100%, dude. Yeah, they don't have antibiotics in the 1870s yet, right?
No.
I don't know. Japan's, you know, mixed up with the Dutch now, and the Dutch had advanced medicine then, but I don't think they had antibiotics yet. Yeah. Yeah, crazy. Do we have any the business of war? You know, I mean, that's one of our common through lines. And
it's good, right? Is that where we're at?
We are not.
Okay. It's good business. Make a buck
very
off of it.
Yeah, very productive.
It has always
been profitable. Is what I'm looking for.
Yeah, and that's if you got soldiers with nowhere else to go, somewhere else that needs soldiers is a good place to send them.
Mm-hmm. And I, for one, think are a $1.X trillion budget is perfectly fine for a military.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, sending military advisors is always really successful.
I don't know if the military has enough money. I think we should double or triple that budget.
Oh boy.
That's how you get to be president, baby.
That's true.
So I think at this point we can probably render a verdict on The Last Samurai. What do we say? Shelf or trash? Shall we slash it with the katana or do we put it on the wall? What do you say, Arthur?
As of right now, I am very lightly going to put it on my shelf. I got quite a kick out of it.
I also think it's very lightly shelfable. You know, you got to have conversations about it and sort of talk about what it means ideologically. But at the end of the day, it is a very sick action movie and the sort of kind of historical blockbuster epic that is in short supply. So and Zwick is an interesting journeyman filmmaker.
Yeah, for sure. I would put it on the shelf also with an asterisk. You know, this is problematic, but it's also in my wheelhouse of things that I like to think about. And so it's got a lot of great stuff going on with it. We didn't even talk about the sort of troubling masculinity of the movie.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Couldn't even. I mean, then we got to get into like all of samurai culture.
Right.
And yeah. Patriarchal structures, and we've done that throughout our Lynch marathon.
Forcing the widow to, I mean, just wild. I mean,
there's a ton of that in Shogun, too, right?
Sure, there is,
wild.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Which, in some senses, is accurate representation.
Sure, exactly.
And it's, I mean, the choices to be accurate and the choices to be inaccurate are telling.
Very true. It's very funny when Algren's like, I'll help you with the laundry. And she's like, men don't do that. Or Japanese men don't do that. He's like, I'm not Japanese. Yeah, okay, sure.
Sure.
Sure, this guy in the 1870s is helping her with laundry.
Yeah.
Because American men were so gender egalitarian
so
in the late 19th century.
Helping out with the household chores,
But you're right, it's telling, as you say.
Very, very telling. So there you go. We're probably wrong about everything we've said so far. And Dalton's going to tell you how you can tell us we're wrong.
That's right. If you want to tell us who should have been the star of The Last Samurai, I almost said The Last Action Hero. That too. Which is better, Last Samurai or Last Action Hero?
Oh, Last Action Hero.
Interesting. A conversation for another day, but you can let us know what you think at goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. That is the name of the show you're listening to at gmail.com. You can also find the show on this show and this network, this project. You can find us on the internet at Good Trash Media, all over social media, mostly on Instagram at Good Trash Media, and find written content from us and our friends at goodtrashmedia.com. You can also find other podcasts under the Good Trash Media umbrella in your podcatchers. The Praise Down with Heath and Alex, The Wheel of Randy with Dan Wade. Very good shows that you can check out right this very second on your podcatcher of choice. You know, rate, review, subscribe, all that bullshit they tell you to do on every podcast you listen to. We also want to tell you to do that. It helps us out, whether it's this show or another show on the network. You know,
just tap those little stars to let the internet know you're a fan. Because somewhere, some way, a little AI algorithm is going, they like the Good Trash Genre Cast. I guess I should tell other podcast movie listeners that they should listen to the Good Trash Genre Cast. And that's how the algorithm works, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Last but certainly not least, if you want to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/GTM. Find out what's in it for you. Stuff like picking a movie for us to discuss on this very show, or, having a Blu-ray sent to your house based on a little survey that you fill out for Arthur. The Arthurtron 9000 is our patented device, perfect at figuring out what kind of movies you need in your collection. That's it. That has been your social media and content contacting us corner. There we go. Arthur, we've got April in the bag. Do we have another marathon queued up for May, or we got more potpourri?
No, we got a marathon, baby.
I love a good marathon.
Good.
Next week, we start a new marathon that I'm calling For the Love of the Movies. And it's movies about making movies.
Classic.
Hollywood loves itself. And other cinemas love themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
And next week, we start off with a little favorite from 1992, which is none other than Robert Altman's The Player.
Okay.
Oh, very fun. Okay. Very good. I like getting some Altman. So
interesting.
Sounds like a good time. Will you keep watching? We'll keep talking, and we'll see you all next time.